for the delay. We're trying to get moving here. So it's just Ann Lane and me in the boardroom. Ann, would you like to lead the pledge?
Most certainly.
Okay.
Do you have to do roll call first, Drew? Oh,
okay, roll call.
Ann Lane, hi.
I think she's going to, Angela, you're going to.
Yes, I was going to do it after the pledge, but I'll go through, and if you could just state your name and where you are and if anyone's in the room with you. Sally Griffin?
Yes, I'm at home in Melvin Village.
Ann Lane?
Yes, I'm here in the boardroom with Drew.
Kate Cassidy?
I'm here at my office in Littleton, New Hampshire, closed doors.
Bill Nazara?
I am at my home office in Newmarket, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
Helen Honoreau?
I am in Nashua, New Hampshire, in my office with the door closed.
And finally, Drew Klein.
I am here in the boardroom with Ann Lane.
Thank you.
All right, you're off.
I pledge allegiance to the flag.
Of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, a nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And is that the White House?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's appropriate for Anne to do the pledge today because not only is she in the room, her dress has the White House on it. It's really pretty amazing. So very, very.
You have to send a picture.
Yeah. Okay, so first up, we have, we're not going to do oral public comment, obviously, that's written. Angela, do we have any written public comment submitted?
We did have one, and it was submitted with all the board materials to the board members, as well as posted to the public materials that are on the web, on the board's webpage.
Okay, but none other than that one we got.
Nothing in the interim.
Okay. So our first one is student versus profile school board. Do we have a party here?
My name is Kimberly Kaprowski. I'm the profile board chairman.
Okay, and the parent is here.
Yes. My name is Monica LaFlamme, and I'm here on one line, and Scott LaFlamme, Jordan's dad, is on another line.
Okay. So the way we do our hearings, we're Ms. LaFlamme, you will go first. You have 10 minutes to give us any background. So this is not a rehearing of your case. We're not trying the case. We've all received the written materials. We've all read through everything. So I'm sure Steve Berwick sort of walked you through the process. So you've got 10 minutes to, you know, sort of give us any background, any info in explaining your case that you think we need to know. And if you're ready, I will go ahead and start a timer. And I can get my timer working here. I'll let you know. And then if you get, you have 10 minutes, you do not have to take the 10 minutes if you don't do, you need to take that long. But I'll give you a warning when we're coming up to the end of that. Is all that clear?
Yes.
Scott LaFlamme is on. Can you hear me?
Who is that?
Scott LaFlamme, I'm just doing a check to see if you can hear me.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, thank you for attending. I apologize just for this setup. I know that this isn't ideal, so there may be a little lag between what you say and the time it takes us to catch it, to ask questions. There may be some interruptions. So if we interrupt you, it's not out of rudeness. It's just because of the technology here. There's a little bit of latency there. So I'm going to go ahead and start you as soon as you start speaking, so the floor is yours.
Okay, good morning. First thing I want to do is Monica, Jordan, and I want to thank New Hampshire Department of Education for taking the time to hear this case. It's been a long, couple of months, and we appreciate it. The only information that I would like to add to the findings outlines a due process violation that was not included in the findings as written by Scott Johnson. So let's see, on May 11th, I requested from the Profile School Board some information that was provided to them by the principal of the Profile School, and it was provided to them for the school board meeting that was held on May 5th. The Profile School Board chair did provide some information to me, but omitted some of the principal's testimony and information because it contained the names of two students. The chair stated in an email that to share that information for your appeal, and I'm quoting this, would violate FERPA privacy law. I totally understand that comment. Again, it's my contention that the Profile School Board did not provide due process when it withheld that information because of the FERPA law. What they could have done at that point, I believe, is provide the information, redacted information to me and Monica, so we would have the complete picture and see exactly what was stated by the principal at that point. So basically what it did is it left us in the dark from some of the information, and that was not shared with Scott Johnson. Monica and I discovered that a little later after the hearing with Scott Johnson.
Mr. LaFlamme, I'm not sure we are actually allowed to consider new information that's not in the packet. So I don't really think that's something we can necessarily consider, but I appreciate you, trying to give us the full view here of this situation. So does any board member, I'd like to just allow the board members to ask, are there any questions of the family? No questions? So, Mr. and Ms. LaFlamme, are there any other things that you would like to point out to us or make sure that we are aware of?
I think, no. I'm sorry. Sorry, Scott.
Monica, go ahead. I'm sorry. We're walking on each other. The delay.
I just wanted to say that I think that the due process that we got with Attorney Johnson and his summary is excellent. There's just a few little things in it, and one of them is what Scott just brought up. I believe the documentation is part of the packet. It's just we only recently realized that what she had written about the redaction, or not redaction, but the omission of some of, or of one of Principal Sheehan's hyperlinks for her. For us to see, and the board saw it, is my understanding, and of course Terry had it, but we, even though we didn't get the information until many days later, that was omitted as well. So just, it wasn't really a new thing, it was just kind of saying we didn't, it's all part of that one thing, but we just, this just came to our attention.
Okay.
That was.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I'm good.
I'm good as well.
Okay. Do any board members have any questions, clarification? Ann Lane has a question.
It just came to my mind a question with regard to your daughter's, I believe it's a daughter, her status and which school was she technically in her senior year a homeschool student, or was she still considered a Profile High School student?
I can speak to that. This is Monica. She was still considered a Profile student. She left halfway through her junior year to take. didn't leave. She was still at the school taking class, but we moved her bulk of her classes to VLACs for that the end of that semester, for the second semester, because she was kind of appreciating their way of teaching. And she wasn't actually accepted as a full-time student until the end of July of 2009 with VLACs. However, she was also an enrolled student at Profile taking a sociology and then philosophy course. And then in some of the documentation that Principal Sheehan submitted, it also that she was considered actually, at least at the beginning of the year, a full-time student with them. But we're not arguing that. We know she was full-time with VLACs, but she never stopped taking classes or being part of the class of 2020 at Profile throughout this entire thing.
Are you able to confirm which institution received the adequacy aid?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
I think the question was which school received her state adequacy aid, Profile, school district, the high school there, or the VLACs. I assume it would be VLACs since she was enrolled as a VLAC student.
I don't know the answer to that. We had that question, actually, because she was also listed
okay,
full-time.
Yeah, I believe the commissioner would be able to. Commissioner, are you there? Can you answer that question?
I am, and so what I can tell you relative to the student is my understanding that the student during their senior year was a home education student that was taking classes at VLACs as well as participating in classes at the Profile High School. The way that the adequacy payments work, they are paid in arrears. So this year, Profile High School would have received 100% adequacy for that student. And then next year for that student, they would receive adequacy for the courses that the student took at Profile.
And that's because of the one-year delay.
Correct.
So in 2020, they're actually getting the funds for 2019.
Correct.
And in 2021, they'll be getting the funds for 2020.
Yep, so they will receive adequacy payments related to the courses that the student took at Profile High School.
Okay, a couple of courses. And the VLACs will get the payments for the bulk of the course.
For the VLACs classes.
Well, okay, again, she was never a homeschool student. She was always a full-time student within the New Hampshire school system. VLACs is online. It's not homeschooling. There's a very distinct difference between the two. So, again, just a point of clarification because that
sure.
term seems to be used a lot in our community.
Right, and I think we understand that, and just for any board members who might not be clear, the way VLACs works is that she was a full-time VLAC student, so she's enrolled in VLAC, but just because of the way it works, legally, she's classified as a homeschool student to make sure she's counted under the truancy law, so she's not listed as truant. I think that clarified in the rule going forward, but technically, legally, I think there's a classification that they're a homeschool student, even though they're actually a full-time VLAC student. So we understand the distinction. I appreciate you pointing it out. Does anybody else have any questions?
Yes,
oh, go ahead.
Through the end of her junior year, she was technically still classified as full-time, I guess, with Profile because she only transferred her courses. It takes a process to get a full-time student status at VLACs, which takes several months. So that came in at the end of July going into her senior year.
Okay.
I don't know how the funding works. I don't know on either side how the funding works.
Okay. Are there any other questions? All right, hearing none, Mr. Mizzle-Flam, thank you very much. We are going to turn it over to the Profile School District.
Hi, yes, this is Kimberly Kaprowski. I'm the chair for Profile School Board.
Welcome.
Thank you.
All right, so the floor is yours. Again, we have all the written materials. If there's anything that you would like to add or clarify, to help us understand this?
I did want to clarify a few things. One was that even though the hearing officer found that there was an alleged denial of due process, there wasn't any time when either the LaFlammes, except till just now what I heard on the speaker, or the hearing officer could specify what information was lacking in order to make that a true denial of due process. The parents submitted to me as the board chair over 50 exhibits at the time for their hearing with us on May 5th, and those were all shared with my board. There was a concern that the rebuttal from Principal Sheehan was not shared with them. And the problem with that was, well, several fold. One was that we're in the middle of a pandemic. And so ideally this whole thing would have been very different and we would have all been able to meet. But Principal Sheehan submitted her rebuttal to me the night before the hearing. And the next day I tried to get in touch with her and see if she was done with it so I could forward that to everyone. She was not in her office that day when I called, and when I tried to call her on her cell phone, I did not know that her cell phone had died. So she was unreachable that day, and so the first time anybody saw that rebuttal was that evening. But her rebuttal was based on all the emails and the exhibits that were submitted by LaFlammes. There wasn't any new information for them other than a couple court cases that really our board even found irrelevant. And the other concerns as far as the due process, you know, again, these are unprecedented times. And so we're in the middle of a COVID pandemic. And I had two concerns that were my primary concerns for this hearing at the school for the parents. One was that we follow all the regulations of the governor. And at the time, you couldn't meet in more than groups of 10. You had to stay 6 feet apart. All of us brought masks to the meeting as well, even though we were 6 feet apart. The other rule was keeping everyone as safe as possible and making sure that we followed those rules. And my second concern was making sure that everyone was hurt, both the LaFlammes and the principal, and that my board was present to hear everybody. So that evening when we signed on, we had five of our six board members there in this cafeteria area, along with the principal, who did host the meeting because the school has to host the Zoom meetings. I mean, there really wasn't a way for us to do it otherwise. And I didn't realize until I got there that evening that there was a waiting room option for you to use on Zoom meetings. I thought we were going to have to kind of shut the Zoom down and then get another number and reopen it somehow. What we were able to do was put all the people who were not part of the deliberation with the board into that waiting room. So the parents went into the waiting room. The superintendent went into the waiting room. And then the principal left and went to her office, which is another part of the school. And so the only people that were deliberating were my six board members, and then our board clerk was there taking minutes. So there was no one else there. I know that that was a concern, that the principal didn't leave, but I have several witnesses that wasn't an issue. The other thing, too, was that all of those people were able to call in. In fact, even the secretary of the school wanted to ask something of the principal, and she had called in that night. And was just in the public portion for just a minute, and then she left. So we had five groups of people that were able to call into the Zoom meeting. Why Senator Starr, if he or his associate really wanted to call into the meeting that night, I'm not sure, and I can't really understand why he had difficulties calling in, because everyone else was able to call in that night. And I summarized his letter. I didn't get a letter from Senator Starr until the 5th, the day of the meeting. And I did summarize that letter that night for the board and at the meeting. But there was never a mention during the meeting that Senator Starr was going to try to call in. We were never notified of that until after the meeting. And there was also no attempt by the parents that night during the meeting to say that more information was left out. In fact, in order for me to make sure everybody really felt heard, I gave both parties the opportunity to rebut twice, not just once. So it was a long meeting because everyone had plenty of time to get that information out there that they wanted to share. I think that's pretty much all that I wanted to make a point of. There was one other thing that the parents were concerned because the principal was there in person and they were not. Again, to keep with that under 10 people rule, I could not have had everyone there. And I wanted a place where my board, where we could have as few people as possible so we could have the principal leave entirely and it was just the board and one other board member on Zoom that would deliberate. But with that in mind, the body language I know was a concern for them. Most of us had computers as well as the main screen in the computer. We all brought laptops as well, most of us. So I would say that probably, for me at least, it was easier for me to read the parents' body language than sometimes the principal because it was fairly dark in the room. We had the lights down. It was dusk. And we had the screen kind of turned up so we could see the parents, and we had the lighting in the room down a little. So it was actually quite easy to see the body language from the parents, even more so than Principal Sheehan. But I will say that, you know, I think we did the very best that we could during the circumstances of COVID-19, and I truly feel that these parents were heard, and so I just wanted to make sure that that was understood.
Okay, this is Drew Klein, the chair of the board. I have a couple of clarifying questions. Which individual person was actually running and operating the Zoom meeting?
Principal Sheehan started the meeting on the Zoom, and then I got up a few times. There wasn't really anyone doing anything with the computer during the meeting. When we got to deliberations, Principal Sheehan moved some people to the waiting room, but we were all right there with her watching her do that. And then she left. She was gone. I had to actually, when we were done our deliberations, I went and got her to have her come back in, and that was it.
Okay. As a follow-up, so the principal is a party to this case. Was there no one else in the entire school district who was capable of running a Zoom meeting? Why have the principal initiate the meeting and be at the controls, even if it was just in the beginning, when the principal is a party to the case?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if the secretary could have done it. I don't know.
And the principal,
I know if one of us did it as an individual, you know, we would have had to have paid for a Zoom account, I believe, because I believe educators get a discount to have the Zoom account.
Well, I mean, so the school district has the account, so presumably, or the school itself, there would be multiple people with the technical know-how to actually just start a Zoom meeting. It's really not that hard. I'm just curious why the principal was the designated person to be at the controls of the meeting. That would seem to be an obvious potential issue, at least from an appearance standpoint, to have one of the parties to the case at the controls of the meeting.
Yeah, I suppose whether you have, you know, a slideshow or anything, you know, somebody that was there would run that. I didn't find that to be a conflict personally. And I had, you know, like I said, there were five of us sitting in the room as witnesses watching everything that was going on. So,
So for the principal's rebuttal and the timing of that, can you just clarify the principal's rebuttal? You received it the night of the hearing?
No, I received it the night before the hearing. I received it on the evening of May 4th.
Okay. And then what time the next day was the hearing?
The hearing the next day was at 5:30.
And so that was delivered to the parent when?
At the meeting that next night. the principal had sent me her rebuttal and had said, this is what I think I'm planning on submitting tomorrow evening. And so for me, that was kind of like, well, is this done or is it not done? That was my question. And so by the time I saw it and read the whole thing the next morning and then attempted to get a hold of her, I literally couldn't get a hold of her, and I kept trying and trying.
But wouldn't it be proper to give that rebuttal to the parents before the meeting so they'd have time to read it and prepare a response?
Yes, I would have liked to have done that, yes. And that's why I gave everyone two chances to rebut that night as well.
Do any other board members have questions?
I do not.
No one else? Okay, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
At any time, if you have a question, feel free to press *5.
Well, I'll start the discussion. I have a couple of concerns here. It does appear to me that this process was just on its face unfair to the parents. Just from a procedural standpoint, regardless of the outcome, I'm not judging the outcome here, but the process from an appearance point of view, you shouldn't have, first of all, a party to the case physically in the room with the other party not allowed that access. They should be on equal footing. A party to the case shouldn't be running the meeting at the technical controls. That's just obvious. And when one of the parties submits a late document, that should be given to the other party immediately before the meeting so they can have a chance to go over it. So there do appear to be few cases here, a few points where I think you could make a pretty strong case that it was an improper process. That said, the parents withdrew their main contention about participating in the graduation. So that point is moot, and what we're left deciding is not any sort of remedy that would be available to the parents. There is no remedy. Really all we would have is a reprimand to the school district. And I think, just for me, speaking for myself, and I want to hear what the other board members think, I find that the case is moved by virtue of the fact that graduation has happened, the parents withdrew that complaint, and there's no remedy here. But it's also worth pointing out to the district that this process does appear to be problematic and that best practice would advise not to do that sort of thing in the future. Does anybody else have any thoughts on that?
Drew, I have my electronic hand raised.
Okay, go ahead, Helen.
Thank you. I think the request is moot, so we can't, the parents chose to withdraw the request. We can't do anything about that. I share your concerns about the due process that was afforded to the parents, but I struggle with what we're able to put into an order. I think the hearing officer did a good job addressing the due process position here, and I would like that to be part of any order, that there are concerns about the due process that the school district followed. Certainly we are in COVID-19 uncharted waters, but there is a real appearance of impropriety here. I don't think it was intentional, but I do think there were concerning results, that the parents were not permitted to be there, that they're a party, and one of the parties wasn't permitted to be there, that the principal was running the meeting. the concern about the one witness that wasn't able to connect, it creates a situation you don't want to have to deal with, that one of the parties was running the meeting and then a witness for the other side couldn't get in. I don't think the principal did anything intentionally. I don't think, the technology is imperfect. You saw that we started our meeting late because we couldn't get the technology going. Those things happen, but you've got to avoid even the appearance of impropriety. And so I do have concerns about the due process and the principal's rebuttal. I know that the chair tried to remedy the situation by allowing two opportunities to speak. That's not the same as having advance notice. And so that is just another concern. Bottom line, the request is moot. But I do think that there has to be something in an order that goes back that says the due process considerations were not adequate and need to be resolved. I'm done.
Anyone else have any thoughts?
I'm just showing that Sally has her hand raised.
Go ahead, Sally.
Yes, I just wanted to reiterate, what Helen said, and Drew, I agree. We just need to make sure, and I'm not sure under, what jurisdiction that due process in this case, where it lies. I'm not sure, but I believe that, yes, it appeared that their due process was not upheld. So I don't know. What's the remedy here?
Well, that's the question. I think there's really not a remedy. We can't go back.
But whose jurisdiction? Do we set guidelines for due process, or is that's at the local level? Or?
Right.
To
Helen's point, which is a great point, so obviously I think we have a moot main contention here, but the question is, if we're going to issue an order, I'm not really sure that an order is the proper step for us to take, because again, there's really nothing to order unless we would make an order that says, in the future, don't do this. But maybe phrasing it, rather than issuing an order, a strongly worded letter to suggest that process is not, it gives the appearance of being improper. Again, I'm reluctant to, without judging the principal's intentions here, and that's not what I think we're doing, we're just pointing out that the process gave the parents legitimate complaint, and maybe instead of an order, just giving some guidance on what a proper process would look like going forward would be the better option for us. Helen or anyone else have some thoughts on that?
Hey, Drew, it's Kate.
Hi, Kate.
Hi. Just reflecting back, it says here that the profile school board should review ED-204-01 due process requirements, because that's what
yep.
it comes down to, is they did not follow that.
Well,
they should go over that. The chairman of the board should go over that again on 204.
Yeah. I mean, that was the hearing officer's recommendation, and I think it's sound. We could, but again, I think there's, from the school district point of view, there's some potential gray area in that we can issue an order saying go back and read that and familiarize yourself with it. But I think given the situation with these sorts of new procedures that we're doing, it might be worth us pointing out, in addition to that, that there are ways to run a meeting like this that avoid giving the appearance of favoritism. And in addition to just reading the rule, it might be worth pointing out where the actual flaws were in this past process, at least the appearance of flaws. Does that make sense?
Phil Nazaro has a question.
Go ahead, Phil.
Hey, it's not necessarily a question, but more of a statement. First of all, I completely agree with the perspective Helen gave. I don't think that there was ill intention on the part of the school. I just think that in the attempt to adapt to the remote environment, the appearance of impropriety, I think is just strong enough that we should do something, at least make a statement. I like the fact that in the recommendations from the hearing officer that just referring them back to ED 204.01 puts us on the record as saying, look, we recognize due process is going to be challenging and these procedures can be challenging as long as we're in this remote environment, but that we need to follow the rules and ensure that all parties have equal access.
Yeah.
Just my two cents.
Yeah, I like that. I think maybe we had a motion to conclude that this issue is moot, so we do not come down with a decision on one side or the other. But order that the district reread ED 204.01 and become familiar with its requirements and recommend in the future that in the interest of giving the appearance of fairness and in actually being fair to all parties, that they make sure that all parties are granted exactly the same access to each other's documents, materials, and procedures, and that no party is given an opportunity to at least have an appearance that they're being favored over the other when it comes to having a virtual meeting or an in-person meeting. Anne.
Sure. I'm happy to make a motion, whether it is of the options presented to us, moving that we accept the hearing officer's report and adopt the hearing officer's recommendations, or accept the report and indicate any more specific recommendations. What is the preference?
I think accepting the report, but finding the issue was moot, and then issuing an order to the district to reread ED 204.01 and ensure in the future that no party is favored or that no process is in place that gives the appearance that a party is favored over another. How's that? Does that sound good to everybody? Any clarifications you want to add?
They reviewed 204.01. I couldn't hear the end of what you were saying.
Right. So after that, we recommend that the district reevaluate its procedures for these sorts of meetings to ensure that all parties are given exactly equal opportunities to receive, review each other's documents, all materials related to the case, and that the procedure does not give the appearance of favoring one party over the other. Helen, did you have something?
The only thing I was going to say is, would anyone object to rereading, suggesting that the district reread the hearing officer's recommendations regarding due process? I'm not suggesting they have to that we're ordering that, but he was pretty careful and laid out some good recommendations and just maybe suggest that they review them. Anybody interested in doing that?
I like it. I think it's a good idea.
I like it.
I agree. I like that a lot.
Okay.
Okay. So we'll add that to Anne's motion.
Are you good with
Yeah, exactly. Anne's nodding her head.
I second Anne's motion.
Okay, that was Helen with a second. Okay, roll call, Angela.
All right, Sally Griffin.
Yes.
Anne Lane.
Yes.
Kate Cassidy.
Yes.
Bill Nazzaro.
Yes.
Helen Otero.
Yes.
Drew Klein.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Thank you to both parties. We appreciate your patience. Okay, we're going to move on to item number two, number 4B, Home Education Advisory Council Annual Report. And before we do that, I just want to remind everybody the process we have when you are supposed to hit the whatever it is you hit, star five or whatever it is, to raise your hand, I don't see that. So the administrator sees that. So if you want to speak, I'm fine with you just piping up and asking to speak without doing that. But you should identify yourself first for the transcription, just so everybody listening will know who you are. Okay, so Catherine Michelotti, are you here?
I am here. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me. I am Catherine Michelotti, the chairman of the Home Education Advisory Council. Did everyone receive my annual report?
I did.
Yeah.
Okay, since we are on a phone meeting, would you like me to read the report, or would you prefer that we go right to questions since you have all seen it, or does it need to be documented since the call is being recorded?
No, I think we've all read the report, and it's in the materials, which have been made public, so anybody who wants to access that on our website can access the report.
So okay, wonderful. Then in the interest of saving you guys some time, if anyone has questions, please feel free to ask.
Anyone have any questions or thoughts about the report?
I'd like to thank you for the report. It was a nice snapshot into your organization. If you could update us a little bit on, it said that what would be attached would be a list of people on the committee that we did not receive that.
That is on our website.
It's on our website.
I can. It's actually on the State Board of State Department of Education website.
Okay.
So I can
point
to that if everybody wants to see who's on that.
That's great. If there's just any other changes to membership or leadership that you'd like to share, that would be great.
I think I put all the changes into there. We had like I said, Kara Potter, who was from Unschooling New Hampshire, had resigned at the end of her term, and so we are awaiting a nomination from them. Michelle Lavelle, who had been on the Home Education Advisory Council for a while, had, at the end of her term, handed over her position to Katie McLaughlin, and that is from the Seacoast Christian Home Educators Association. Jennifer Pereira had decided to update her, at the end of her term, and she represents Catholics United for Home Education. And then Fred Fraser from Thomas More College had taken Kara Potter's position of secretary, and so now he takes the minutes for our meetings. Currently, Helen Rist is still the placeholder for the School Administrators Association, but she has not been able to attend meetings, so I don't know if we'll be receiving another nomination or if she will still be our placeholder. And so that is the membership updating that I have.
Thank you.
Sure.
And can you just remind us, I think we got this info last year, and I'm not sure you have it off the top of your head, but roughly how many homeschool students are there in New Hampshire?
You mean before March?
Yeah.
Roughly 5% of the school-age students in New Hampshire are homeschooled, and we are seeing an uptick in people asking about homeschooling for this coming year and saying, you know, what can I do? What are the requirements? A lot of parents are very curious right now because they're awaiting, you know, as we all are, the instructions for how schools will open and co-ops and things like that. And so we're seeing a lot of curiosity, and so I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't see several more families decide to homeschool this year.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I really liked in your report how you pointed out that the emergency at-home education, that remote instruction that we were getting, that parents were either happy with or frustrated with, is not technically homeschooling. It's not your typical homeschooling experience. And I thought that was just really worth pointing out. A lot of people are saying, well, homeschooling, is it means this.
Yes, it's a very interesting and important delineation, I think, to differentiate crisis schooling from homeschooling, because I think a lot of parents who are sitting at home with resources from schools, with teachers who are able to help them and thinking, oh my gosh, if I am having this much trouble, how is my neighbor down the street who homeschools her 5 kids doing this on her own without all these resources? And the truth is, you know, our kids are a lot more used to being home and mixing the home environment with the learning environment. And we chose this, so we've read up on it and we've researched, and we have a community that's built in, and everyone else was just thrown into this. And so it's just a vastly different animal. Even if you do have your curriculum and resources provided for you, it's still very difficult to juggle working at home while attempting to stay on top of assignments that your children have. And so I really think that's an important thing to notice, is that crisis schooling is very, very different from what we've chosen to do as homeschoolers. And but that being said, we are here to help any people who are at home and need, you know, extra ideas. Hey, how do I entertain my 3-year-old while my 6-year-old is trying to get this done and my 12-year-old is attempting to do online classes? And I think that's a lot of what we've been able to help people with, is just, hey, here's some creative ideas. Here's a busy bin, or here, you know, have some extra books that you only take out during this time that are really exciting and new. Just to really help people who've been thrown into this, because since we have the experience, we should really avail ourselves to anyone who might benefit from it.
Yeah, and I think your point that homeschoolers have a community and a network, and there are a lot of supports out there,
mm-hmm.
is really important. I think most people have, if they think of homeschooling at all, they probably think of parents on their own.
Right. Yes, it's definitely not me on my own, that's for sure. And even though we have chosen this, we're kind of in weird crisis mode too. I mean, we used to attend 3 co-ops a week on Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Tuesdays, and those co-ops have been, you know, obviously they're not happening. Our swim teams and our bowling leagues have all been canceled, and so even though we've chosen this, homeschoolers are a little bit lonely as well right now.
Well, thank you very much. That was a very informative report.
You're very welcome. Are there any further questions or anything else I can help anyone with?
Yep, I waved.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you, Kate?
Good. And thank you for the percentage amount. But do you know what your actual headcount is at homeschooling when you get done the year? Do you know your actual number of students?
We know the actual number of new students each year because they are reported to the Department of Education, and it's actually up on the department's website of how many new are there each year. Every homeschooler chooses a different participating agency, whether they choose a private school, their local SAU, or the commissioner and the board, Department of Education themselves. And so in order to find the total number of homeschoolers in New Hampshire, one would have to go back and cross-check all the numbers of new homeschoolers that are reported annually and then subtract the number of homeschoolers who have sent in their letters of completion. And I don't know that the manpower is out there for that just yet, but the numbers could be found. It would just require an awful lot of work.
So you just don't
Yeah, Kate, the department, the last time I checked, yeah. it was just under 5,000 students, I think, that we
okay.
had a decent head count for. But I don't know. Okay. I mean, that was last year.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the second question? Okay.
Yes.
Thanks, Drew. You meet September, December, January, April, May, and June. Do you have a certain first week of each month, a certain date?
We meet on the third Thursday of each month from 3:30 to 5. We usually meet in the Board of Ed building, but we have been meeting on Zoom. And we are theoretically meeting every other month, but we held some extra meetings this year so that we could complete the rules that we were working on and vote on them and get them sent ahead, which I think is actually your next agenda item. and so we used a lot of our placeholder meetings on the off months this particular year. And then we did miss one of our regular meetings simply because we did not have enough action items to vote on, and it was just at the beginning of COVID, and I figured people had other things they could be doing with that hour and a half of their time, and so I made a decision to postpone our meeting by a month for that one gap.
So when's your next meeting?
Our next meeting is in September of 2020.
And that's the third Thursday?
Yes, ma'am. And you're welcome to join us if you like. They're all open meeting.
I'm trying to put it in my schedule.
Wonderful.
Okay.
So it should be September. It will either be the 17th or the 24th. I'm not sure if we will be continuing. We had moved it to the fourth Thursday of the month because that helped with some of the scheduling conflicts. So I'm happy to – it's always up on the department's website, but I can also email you personally if you would like to be on the email list.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to move along to legislative updates. Amanda, are you on the line?
I am on the line. Can you hear me?
Could you
yeah.
speak, Amanda?
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, if you could speak a little louder, that would be helpful.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes, for me.
Okay. Shut the door where my fan is, too. Maybe that'll be better. Okay. So the first, I have quite the list for you today, but we should be able to breeze right through it. Item A is Regional Career and Technical Center Lease Aid. As you can see in your executive summary, the purpose for this rule, and this rule actually goes with your item number C, which is the charter school lease aid. Currently, charter school lease aid and career and technical center lease aid are in the same rule in ED 322. What the intent here is to pull charter school lease aid out of ED 322 and create its own rule in ED 323. The main reason for doing this is because the lease aid program was funded for the first time, but they only funded lease aid for charter schools. In going through the ED 322 rules, there are a few things that are different for lease aid for charter schools and lease aids for career and technical centers. So the department thought it would be good to separate those rules. Right now, this proposal, ED 322, simply removes reference to charter schools. Later on, the department plans to go through these rules, and after going through the process for charter school lease aid, see how that process works, and update the ED 322 rules with a new process. But right now, this proposal in front of you is just to remove the reference to charter school.
Okay. Any discussion or motion?
Makes sense.
Ann has her hand up.
I move that the State Board of Education approve ED 322 Regional Career and Technical Center Lease Aid.
I second it, Kate.
Roll call. Sally Griffin? Yes. Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Phil Nazzaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoro?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain. Okay.
All right.
Item B.
So moving to item B. Item B is donations to career and technical education centers. SB 270 was passed not in this legislative session, but the prior legislative session, and it requires the board to adopt rules simply for the form used for donations and how we internally process those forms. So this is a pretty bare bones simple rule. The statute, which I attached for you, or SB 270, which I attached for you, clearly outlines what the requirements and process is. We simply need to incorporate the form by reference in rule. That's all I have right now. And it's an initial proposal, so I'm sure we'll have to tweak this a little bit as the process goes on.
All right, any discussion, motion?
I'll make a motion.
Oh, Kate's got it.
I move the State Board of Education approve the initial proposal for ED 1308, donations to regional career and technical education centers.
I'll second that. Sally Griffin.
Okay,
roll call.
We'll
go. Sally Griffin? Yes. Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Phil Nazzaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoro?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Thank you.
All right.
Item C. This is the charter school lease aid. So this is the one that corresponds with the first item, ED 322, if there's any questions, but it's basically the same as item A.
All right, any discussion, motion?
Motion.
Ann's got a motion.
I move that the State Board of Education approve ED 323 charter school lease aid.
Second it, Kate.
Roll call.
Can we have discussion for one moment on this? I just have one question I forgot about.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. Amanda, I'm just wondering about the term all you need to operate the school. When we get charter applications and when they're approved, there's, you know, often, I think in just about everyone I can remember, a tiered amount of space they're going to need per year. And so while in year one, if you're just starting with kindergarten and first grade, for example, all you need to operate the school is going to be different than the following years. How would this be applied?
I am not the one that can answer that question. These rules were actually drafted by Amy Clark and Caitlin Davis and her team. I wasn't really involved in the process. I would suggest that I will take a note of that question and then get the answer for you, unless Amy or Caitlin are on the line, but I don't think that they are.
I'm on the line. I think Amy is as well.
Oh, okay, great.
Helen, or if you can hear me. And Amy, give her a second. Okay, maybe she's not on. So right now the lease aid program, the way it works is there's just a set amount of lease aid that is that schools are eligible to apply for based on their lease. And we're going through the rules right now and, you know, kind of maybe we could add some modifications that says, you know, you're only eligible for a certain amount for a certain space, but right now it's based on the overall lease of the space. I do want to add that it is a pretty nominal amount of money that they're receiving. The total pot of money this year that was distributed was $200,000 to all of the schools, which I believe was a proration of around 22% of what their request was. And to back up a little bit more with the history, when the legislature invented this program, decided that charter schools would be eligible for lease aid, all they did was go in and say, all right, there's already a lease aid program that's in effect for career tech education centers. Let's add the word charter next to it. And that was about 8 years ago, and now here we are, you know, eight now, and we actually received money in the state budget to run the program, and we couldn't actually run the program because of the way the rules were written. There was paperwork that was required to be requested that we couldn't, that charter schools couldn't get in the middle of the lease. There were, if you remember, maybe 6 months ago now, we had to do an emergency rule to allow us to not have the charter schools have quotes for additional space, because to be eligible for this, the charter schools had to go out and get a quote for, I think it was up to three different spaces, and submit them with the application. Well, it didn't make any sense to have the schools do that in October and November when the program was first funded, when some of the schools have been open for a long time. And I know Nate is on the line too, and Nate has some information about the space. So if he wants to contribute to that, can just jump in.
Go ahead, Nate.
Hi. Yeah, sorry. I was trying to raise my hand there. I don't know if it was working. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Okay, great. So in terms of Helen's comment, too, when it talks about the space, that's more specific to the idea that if you have a lease, we're only going to cover the parts of the lease that are used for the school's purposes. So it's less about looking at which part of the spaces are being used for educational purposes and then expanding for educational purposes, but more to prevent charter schools from running multiple businesses within a space where some of those businesses might not be used for any educational purposes, and whatever portion of the lease would apply to that, they would not be able to receive lease aid on. But I will point out, too, that we don't have that situation right now. It was just put in there to prevent that situation in the future.
Okay, it appears a couple times in the rules that it just has to be the space you're using for the charter, and so that's where I wondered, like, how that would be, you know, because clearly many of the schools get a space that would allow them to be able to move into additional grades when they're ready. So that I just wondered how that was going to be operationalized. Drew, may I ask another question? Drew, can I ask another question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And I don't know if this is a Nate or Amy or who question. Also in the eligibility, the first part says initial building costs of the initial building costs of modifying the building to meet the requirements of the educational program shall be eligible for lease aid if the charter school is required to pay those costs by the terms of the lease. And then what's not eligible is cost to make permanent upgrades or renovations to the lease space. So I wasn't sure how those can be read together because, you know, sometimes they're going into an old mill building and it seems to me that they're doing modifications that are permanent, not just putting down a wall or something. Just wondering how this is going to work for some of our charters thinking about the spaces they go into.
Sure.
I'm not opposed
to
doing this. I'm reading it saying, how's that going to work?
Right. This is Nate again. My understanding of how that works is that if a school goes into a particular space, it's a new space, they're taking a look at it, and they do an inspection, and there's anything that comes up in that inspection that would prevent them from using the space for educational purposes, then lease aid can be used to make whatever updates or modifications to the building to make sure that it's in code with the use of educational space. However, if that building can already be used for educational space, beyond that, you can't make any additional permanent modifications to the building that would increase the value of it. So it's really just anything that will bring the building into code for the use of educational space.
That would be allowable. Nate, can we amend that to make that more clear? Because I took it to mean, the way it's written, I took that to mean, A, the initial building cost when you're modifying, so you just move in and you have to modify it to make it fit, that's allowed. But any modifications after that wouldn't be allowed. But it sounds like what you're saying is if modifications later are needed to get it to code to be used, then that would also be allowed. Is that right?
I don't think so because I don't think you would be able to move into a space if it wasn't already meeting the standards for educational space. So it would have to be something you would do right up front.
Right, but what I mean is I'm just trying to make sure it's clear. So, for example, when a charter school reads this, everybody really understands.
Right.
The way I read it, it's only the initial building and modification that's allowed. So anything after that is not allowed. Once you move in and you're using it as a school, any renovations after that, you can't use the lease aid for it. Do I have that correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
So let's say you have your space, and then you want to expand, as we know lots of schools do, to fill out some more classroom space, and that classroom space has a few issues. You need to put sprinklers or whatever. You need to add, or you need to retrofit it so it can be used for classrooms. That expansion would not be covered, even if it is to have to allow it to use.
I just want to point out.
So the
costs that are being included are costs that would be initially covered in the lease. So in the lease, when they lease the space to somebody to begin with, and they say, all right, well, included in your lease cost, we will remove the drive-through window in the old Burger King, but then that's in the overall lease cost. I think those are the things that are initially eligible. If there were construction that would needed to be done after the fact, they likely wouldn't be in the lease, so it wouldn't be something that would be eligible for this to begin with. Or just saying what you can and can't include in the overall the request. Go ahead.
Well, what happens if you're expanding into some more space? Like we know several charter schools that have done this, that have had some space, and then there's room next door, the tenant mm-hmm. vacates, and you want to expand, and so you have to add to your lease. You need a new lease agreement to expand into that space. So you're expanding your square footage, your footprint. So it would be revising the lease itself and then expanding into that new space. Would that be covered?
That is a good scenario.
Yeah, that should
that I think
covered.
We definitely need, yeah, I think we need to think about the details and really reflect that in this, so which we can do after the initial proposal. But I think that would be covered because it is in the, it would be a new lease. So, because we're talking about things that would be every, like, so what we're talking about right now is our, the defining umbrella that is for this pot of money is the lease. And then here's all the things that can or can't be included in the lease. Once you have a new lease, then it's a new defining umbrella, and then you have, you know, additional pieces that may or may not fall.
Okay. Yeah, no, I like that. I think maybe we can clarify that going forward. Yeah, who was that?
It was Kate. Okay. North Country Charter did that. We had we did an addition. We expanded in the building. I can't remember, a couple of years ago, but and we did that. It was a new lease, and of course the rate went up. But they did. I remember we contacted the state of New Hampshire, the commissioner, and we went through the process down there. But we didn't get any money from the State Board of Education. We paid that for on our own, but we did have an original lease. I think almost 5 to 10 years later, we put an addition on it, and we rewrote the lease. That's what
right.
we did.
Okay. Well, I think this
just to
we
let
can.
You know that.
Yeah. Thank you, Kate. I think we can maybe move this forward for now with a note here to pay attention to this eligibility portion and revise it going forward. Anne has a question. Or comment.
Could you just clarify on what the source of the grant funding is?
Yeah, it was general funds that were allocated in the legislative approved budget to the Department of Education for distributing lease aid to approved charter schools.
And these funds are reallocated or approved every year?
Yes. So we received $200,000 in fiscal year 20, which is the fiscal year we just closed. They gave us $500,000 to distribute this year, and then the governor or the legislature will decide whether to fund that line. Similarly to how they decide to fund, you know, new building aid projects or additional career and tech education money, it's just a negotiated factor in the department's budget.
Out of curiosity, what factors do they use to determine the amount they're going to approve?
How much they have available.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
Thank you.
This seems to be one of those many areas in the state budget where it does not get funded in lean years. It gets some money in less lean years. Okay, thank you so much. Do we have other discussion or motion?
Yep.
Okay, Anne's ready.
I move that the State Board of Education approve the final proposal for EB 1307.
No, initial proposal.
I'm ahead of myself.
You're ahead by one.
Yeah, already from the page. I move that the State Board of Education approve EB 323 Charter School Lease Aid.
I'll second that, Sally Griffin.
Roll call.
All right. Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Phil Nazzaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoré?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Item B, Robotic Education Grant Fund.
Hi, this is Amanda again. Robotics Education Grant Fund. This is a final proposal. A public hearing was held for this rule on June 11th. The department and the board did not receive any written or oral testimony. I did make one amendment on the last page of the rule, and this was after discussions within the department. We have a application period established in the rules, but the question was, what if during that application period, there's still funds remaining after we've satisfied all of the applications. Can we open another application period? So I added that paragraph on the last page. Not sure it will fly with OLS, but once we submit this, they will advise me on how to correct it.
I like it. Yeah.
I mean, is there a process where schools can request a waiver on any of the rules?
We don't have in our education rules, we don't have an overall waiver rule.
Yeah, I don't think you can get a waiver from these. These are partial alignment with state law, right? So,
right.
The law governs this grant program, and I remember the discussions in the lab. I just have not a detailed recollection, but I remember them talking about wanting to make sure that they weren't just giving money to schools that weren't able to actually create, so they wanted districts and schools to have some skin in the game themselves. That was a real concern. So that's why that portion is there. So it functions more like a matching grant. So Amanda, and I want to put this out to the board, I have a small change in the language that I'd like to propose. Just in the way that it refers to public and charter schools. So if you see at the very top, page one, where part ED 1307 rules for the Robotics Education Fund, right under that, the sentence, the purpose of the fund, et cetera, is to motivate and encourage public school and chartered public school students. I think that's clumsy wording, and it leads to the misperception that chartered public schools aren't full public schools. And so I would like to propose it says public school students, including charter school students.
So public school,
school, including chartered public school students. And then that phrasing is used again in .02, public school or chartered public school. I think we would change that there as well. Public school, including chartered public school.
Okay.
And
also in the definition.
Yeah, in the definitions, just to make it clear, I'll periodically have conversations with people who don't, including legislators, who aren't fully clear that charter schools are public schools, are full public schools.
I agree, Drew.
Yeah. To make that clearer is better.
Okay.
And that's it.
Do you have to put that in a motion to vote on the amendment?
So that's my proposed amendment. Then
okay.
We would need a motion to approve as amended.
As amended, okay.
So, and Anne has raised her hand.
I move that the State Board of Education approve the final proposal for ED-1307, Robotics Education Grant Fund, as amended.
Second.
Right.
Kate
seconds. Roll call.
Any discussion or we're good? Nobody is okay. Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Anne Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Phil Mazzaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoreau? Oops,
yes.
Sorry, Phil. Drew Klein?
Update.
Thank you.
E, update on jail car rules.
Okay, so the next three items are just updates, things that you'll be seeing in the next couple of months. First up is the ED 500 rules. On June 19th, there was a Zoom jail car meeting where they reviewed and discussed the ED 500 rules, which is as you might recall, the four separate proposals, which basically was an overhaul of the rules that grant credentials to educators in New Hampshire. Prior to the GELCAR meeting in June, OLS submitted comments in accordance with the rulemaking procedures. These were substantive comments, which I addressed with Steve Appleby as a conditional approval request to GELCAR. The one substantive comment that we did not address with an amendment to the rule throughout the whole rulemaking process was the term license. OLS continued to flag the use of this term, saying that they didn't believe the board had the legislative authority because the statute calls license a certificate. This was an ongoing issue throughout the whole rulemaking process. And Steve Appleby, Attorney Bond, and I met and discussed that we wouldn't make a change, but we would have a discussion at the next GELCAR meeting. During that meeting on June 19th, it seemed as though a majority of the members of GELCAR would have voted to approve the request. One member stated we should be able to call it whatever we want that makes sense for the department and the board in licensing individuals. But the discussion concluded with a vote to postpone the rules until July 16th because there was a legislative session coming up on June 30th where one of the members of GELCAR, Senator Kahn, thought we could just tag a bill on and start the process of changing the words legislatively. I believe that RSA 21 and 9 was included in that legislative session and changed the term to license, which is a first step. It didn't change all of the statutes that have that word in it, certificate versus license. We are continuing discussions with Senator Kahn. At the next meeting of GELCAR on July 16th, I do anticipate receiving a conditional approval based on our conditional approval request, as well as we will probably receive a recommendation to continue working with the legislature to amend the rest of the relevant statutes with the term certificate, changing that to license. So hopefully by August, we should be able to vote on the conditional approval request and adopt maybe on the same day or at the next meeting. Are there any questions?
No, none for me. Anybody else?
No.
All right, thank you.
All right, and next was charter school rules. I just wanted to update the board that Caitlin Davis and Nate Green have been working on a revision of the charter school rules. I believe we'll see some substantive changes. They weren't ready for this month's meeting, but hopefully we'll have an initial proposal ready for the board to review at the August meeting. So that's coming down the pipe for you.
Okay.
And then home education rules. Attorney Bond and I worked with the Home Education Advisory Committee. I think it's been a year since I started working on them with Kitty and the Home Education Advisory Council. It was definitely educational and eye-opening experience. I think after a lot of back and forth, we worked closely with Kitty and members of the Rules Committee. We have a consensus. It's not perfect, and I don't think we address every individual member's concerns, but we attempted to align the rules with the statute, and Kitty and I will present those rules to you in August. So those
right.
are my updates.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And can I just take this moment to point out yet again that we have rules that don't align with the statute? We keep finding
mm-hmm.
those. It's a constant mining operation to find those and work on them.
And job All security right. for me.
Yeah. okay. Emergency
All right, so
for folk rehab?
Yeah, so this last one is an emergency rule. Voc rehab rules were expiring in January, and we instituted an interim rule. The interim rule is going or expired yesterday. It is important, very important for the citizens of New Hampshire who receive services through vocational rehabilitation that we have rules in place that allow the counselors and the voc rehab staff to continue doing what they need to do to help these individuals. So we need to do an emergency rule. We have an initial proposal already in the works for voc rehab, but because of all the COVID-19 restrictions, that process got delayed. We thought we'd have it done before the interim rule expired. We will need to ask for an extension on that initial proposal, but we do need to get these emergency rules in place. There are no changes. It's the rule exactly the way it is in place right now.
Okay, any questions? All right, any motion?
Can I ask one question?
Yep.
No, not about the home education. Never mind, all set.
Okay. All right, so I think we need a motion for the emergency rule for voc rehab.
Oh, I'm sorry, that is what I have a question about. Can I ask that?
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Amanda, in the rationale for action, it says, the emergency rule is necessary to keep the current rules in place while the department navigates the remainder of the regular rulemaking process. Can you tell me what that means? What's happening? I know COVID put a crimp in people's style, but what's the department trying to navigate?
When we first went under restrictions, voc rehab, our initial proposal, which had substantive changes, was due for a public hearing. But we canceled that public hearing because none of the governor's emergency orders addressed rulemaking meetings. It only addressed public meetings. So for rulemaking, we still have to comply with RSA 541A, and JELCAR and OLS had concerns that Zoom meetings and over-the-phone meetings, 100% over-the-phone meetings, didn't actually comply with a rulemaking hearing. So it took a few months for the AG's office to weigh in and for us to look at other departments' processes for how they were holding public hearings. And we finally held that public hearing at the last meeting. But that was a three-month delay in the voc rehab rulemaking process. But also, I explained last month that our initial proposal removed all of the duplicative language from the federal regulations. And since then, in reading the auditor's report of what we're supposed to have rules for, Lisa Hatt and I have been working on adding language back in. So between our initial proposal and our final proposal, we've made more substantive changes. So we need to have another public hearing because the final proposal is not going to look anything like the initial proposal. So next month we'll have another public hearing and then hopefully be ready to vote on a final proposal.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, I think we're ready for a motion.
I move that the State Board of Education adopt the emergency rule for vocational rehabilitation program PD 1000.
That was Ann.
Second it, Kate.
Roll call.
Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane? Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Phil Nazzaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoro?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. CTE, Laura.
Hi, Laura Stumpkin here. I joined from the State Boardroom.
Did everybody catch that? Laura's here?
Yep.
Go ahead. So we have St. Anselm College substantive change request up front.
Sure. So I just want to confirm that Laura was last piece on the line.
Yes, I am.
Hello.
Hello.
So Laura Wazlewski is representing St. Anselm's College in regard to an extension. It's a very brief extension of all the programs to be aligned with the same expiration, and they are set and scheduled for a site review next year.
Yep. Anybody? Yeah. Ann?
Good morning. Thank you for being here today. This is just a question to clarify for me and perhaps one of the board members. We initially voted our initial approval on August 24th, 2017 through April 30th, 2020 this year, and then November 2018, we extended until the 31st of 2021. Our computer science minimum standards were approved during the course of 2018, toward the end of the year, and then some initial implementation began in 2019. Could you confirm and or verify that your teaching program incorporates all of the standards, the minimum standards included in our relatively newly adopted computer science standards?
Laura, are you there?
Yes, hello. This is Laura Wazlewski. I apologize. I was talking and muted. We were initially approved the computer science program.
Can I interrupt you a second? You're pretty soft. You sound like you're far away from a mic, or you're got a static issue. Can you maybe adjust and try to be a little louder?
Can you hear me now?
That's better. Thank you.
Better? Okay. Yes, we were initially, shortly after the computer science program was approved, our new program was approved, and the reviewer commented that we had implemented all of those standards. However, we do not have any students currently enrolled in that program, and we're requesting a 5-month extension just so that all of our other programs were aligned. And this was per request of the co-chairs designated by the CTE at our MOU meeting early this May, just so that we could streamline resources and not schedule an additional visit.
Thank you. I appreciated that. I simply want a confirmation that our new standards have been incorporated into your training.
Any other question or discussion? Okay, motion.
The State Board of Education moves to grant St. Anselm the extension of ED612.33 Computer Science Program approval through August 30th, 2021.
Kate, second it.
Roll call.
Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Bill Nazaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoré?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Laura Wazalewski.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, item B.
All right, so Laura Stoneking again. Joining us should be Paige Tompkins, Executive Director from Upper Valley Ed Institute, Becky Whitler, faculty member at Upper Valley Ed. And just to note, I don't believe they're online, but Brian Walker.
I am.
Oh, you are here. Hi,
sorry,
Brian.
Laura. Paige Tompkins is here.
And
Becky Whitler, I'm also here.
And okay. Brian Walker was a new chair, orchestrating a new program review along with a local educator out of Ware, Judy Kahn. And so Judy and Brian reviewed the proposal to implement two new programs, one that builds upon the other, one for reading and writing teachers, and then the second for reading and writing specialists.
Upper Valley Ed is here to answer any questions you may have. Anyone have any questions? All right. Well, thank you for attending. It must have been a great application.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks so much for your work on this.
Family. The State Board of Education moves to grant Upper Valley Educators Institute full approval of the following two programs. Reading and writing teacher post-baccalaureate full expiring August 31st, 2022, and reading and writing specialist post-baccalaureate full expiring August 31st, 2022. The State Board, through August 31st, 2022.
I'll second that. Sally Griffin.
Okay. Roll call. Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Bill Nazaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoré?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
I'm staying.
Thank you.
Okay.
So this is Laura Stoneking again. Thank you, Upper Valley Ed and Associates.
Thank you.
All right. Moving on to the next item, item C, which is the fall review at New England College. We should have joining us from New England College, Suzanne Canale.
I am here.
Wayne Lesbrin.
I'm here as well.
Pat Corbett.
I am here.
And the two review co-chairs, Kelly Moore Dunn and Chris Ward.
Hi, I'm here. This is Chris Ward.
So in the fall, actually, just actually as I had joined on with Ed Prep, NEC had a full site review for all but four of their new programs. The review was held at NEC. It was a pretty extensive analysis, and we have NEC reps available to answer any questions. Regarding the recommendation for conditional two-year approval for the listed program.
Any questions?
Drew, I do.
Go ahead.
And I didn't electronically raise my hand. I'm sorry.
Helen, for the record.
So, yes, this is Helen Honoré. Laura. Our Laura. I don't know if we have a lot of Lauras, but DOE, Laura. If you could remind me, what will happen if we go with the condition, the recommendation of the conditional approval on all of these programs? I know that there will need to be reports, and they need to address the recommendations. What happens if there's a concern that the recommendations are not being appropriately addressed in the six-month or year report?
Sure. So usually the first step on a conditional approval is providing documentation of how the unmet standards are being addressed so that they move from being unmet to met. They are then filtered through the council, and then the council makes the recommendation, either continue to work on the unmet standards, they may provide some suggestions or guidance as to what they may be able to do for those. And then once the council has made their recommendation, that would then come to the state board. So I would assume, from what I've seen in years past in documentation, most institutions meet the standards within 6 months to a year. Are you asking if it goes longer than that?
Well, I was asking sort of a process question. At the 6 months, you know, I know this is going to be submitted to the CTE. Does it then come back to the board? Or do we not see it again for 2 years?
No, I would bring it back to the board with what the CTE has made for a recommendation. And then the state board always has sovereign authority over making the decision whether that conditional approval is maintained and additional requirements are needed or those conditions are met. And then they can move to full approval. And then the third option, process-wise, is always non-approval.
Okay. That helps me understand the process. Drew, may I ask a few questions of our representatives from New England College?
Absolutely.
Great. While I recognize that there have been a lot of changes, that the number of students in going through your programs has declined, there was the merger with the art education school, I'm still seeing lots of concerns. And I hear that there is a commitment to the students in the education department, that they represent a large portion of the student body, but getting twos or two approaching three on every single program caused me great concern. There seems to be some overall commonalities that the data collection, when it's being done, and it's not consistently being done, is not being used to inform decision-making and to do assessment. There's so many programs here, you know, looking at the physical education program, and you have a candidate saying there aren't enough classes or opportunities for me to sort of learn my craft, and there are courses that are attempting to address all teachers versus content specificity. And we have been focused quite a bit on this board on making sure that content knowledge is really first and foremost for the students coming out of our program. So I know I've generalized a lot, and it would take a very long time to go through each of these programs. So I tried to pull out what I saw as a general problem across the board, Would you folks be willing to address what you're planning to do?
Well, this is Wayne Lesprince. Let me start, and then I'm going to ask Pat and Suzanne to speak to this as well. So I think the phrasing that I used when we met with the review team review was that, in my view, content is king, that content should drive everything that we do. And in my capacity as the Vice President of Academic Affairs, what I have stressed to both Pat Corbett and Suzanne is that I want to make sure that emphasis placed on content is throughout. And I remember in the conversations with our review team, there was a lot of nodding of heads. The emphasis on content is critically important. As a college professor before becoming VPAA, content was everything. And so I think that the emphasis on content that you've identified in your work is absolutely appropriate, and it's exactly in line with where we want to be. But you're right. We have had some turnover in our leadership. I'm in this role now and going into my third year. Pat and Suzanne have come into these roles recently, and all of us are aligned with what you've described as priorities in terms of making sure that this program is the best program, becomes an exemplary program here in New Hampshire. We took very seriously this review process. We saw this as an opportunity to share everything and to sit with our reviewers and learn from them and to take from them guidance that we have incorporated into our way forward, which we've also shared with them. And I believe that what you'll see in that plan speaks exactly to the concerns that were raised by students, the concerns that were raised by reviewers, and certainly in line with what you've just mentioned in your questions. So I wanted to offer that just sort of as context, because there is no degree of separation between where what we're working on and what we're working to get to and what you've described as a goal. But let me ask Pat and Suzanne to talk to you a little bit more about the specifics, especially around content, but more generally about what we're doing to get ourselves in line with the state standards.
Sure. Thank you. This is Pat Corbett, and I will start. One very important piece that we've put in place since the review is we have moved Suzanne Canale, who is here with us today and who is what we call a guru with the state standards. We have moved her into the Director of Teacher Certification role. So her primary focus now is to address the feedback from the report, the deficiencies in our program, and then move us forward to where we need to be. So this is a change where before we would have a contracted person making a stipend to oversee these processes. Now we have a full-time position dedicated to this process. And with that, I am now the Dean of Undergraduate Programs. One of my primary responsibilities is to still work with this team and move these things forward to at my level, which does help because we do have resources and budget behind this to help us move forward. So the greater NEC College is behind this. They're supporting us. They're giving us those resources that we need. I'll let Suzanne speak to some of the specifics that she will be now putting in place in her role.
Sure. Thanks, Pat. This is Suzanne. And Helen, thank you for your question. First, I just want to express your question about data and the numbers of students, the decline in the number of enrolled students. There is a decline in all preparatory programs. There's a decline in enrollment. But this is like this, you can see, is pretty serious, down to 2, in some cases 0. So when I first came on, that was one of my questions. What is happening? And I think that what happened is a bunch of things. You know, it'd be nice to say that these 3 specific things happened or didn't happen, and that's why. But the contributing factors, I think, are there was a lot of turnover in terms of leadership, and leadership is needed to help faculty, especially faculty who maybe have been teaching in higher ed for a long time, that ed prep is changing and it needs to change. So you need a leader there who's going to actually help faculty either embrace it, embrace the change, or move on. The other part is the content piece, that there's ed prep in a lot of higher ed institutions. Education is totally separate from the content. And I hear you, Helen, when you say that the State Board is concerned about future educators having the content they need. So one of the first things I did when we merged was I met with Wayne and Pat and the head of the graduate division, and we talked about how are we going to bring these programs together. And I expressed at that meeting that we need more content. It's almost like I'm not trying to downplay the importance of the educator preparation courses that we offer, but the content is king. That is the thing that holds an educator solid in the classroom. And educators get so much professional development throughout their career. We need to make sure in these 4 years they're getting their content. So we are making the change, and we're slowly moving over, I hope, to having students actually major in their content area when they come in and follow a practice that I performed at the New Hampshire Institute of Art, which is to partner with the content people so that there is constant communication, that we're involved when there are key signature assessments, whether it be a presentation or an opportunity for them to share some creation. But I'm hoping that we can start building that at NEC.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions or discussion? Okay, then I guess we'll have a motion.
Okie dokie. Ann Lane. The State Board of Education moves to grant Lynn College 2-year conditional approval of the following 10 programs through August 1st of 2022. Elementary education K-8 undergraduate conversion conditional, secondary English 5-12 undergraduate conversion conditional, special education programs undergraduate conditional, secondary education mathematics 7-12 undergraduate conversion teach out conditional, physical education undergraduate conversion conditional, secondary education life sciences undergraduate conversion conditional, secondary social studies 5-12 undergraduate conversion conditional, theater education undergraduate conditional, and specialty areas superintendent graduate conditional, school principal graduate conditional.
All right, second, someone?
If this is Angela, there's an additional piece, I think, on the motion. It says additionally in accordance with ED, do you see that?
Additionally, in accordance with ED 602.13, New England College shall develop a progress report. This report shall be submitted to the department within 6 months of the State Board of Board's approval decision.
Thank you.
Okay, so now we need a second.
Second, Kate.
Thank you, Kate. Roll call.
Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Bill Nazaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoro?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Thanks.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, item D, UNH.
All right, last of CTE for a while. All right, so this is D. This is UNH. UNH has submitted for a substantive change to add an additional proposed format level to both theater and dance. Currently, it is offered as both a Master of Education or a Master of Arts in teaching, and they would like to add the bachelor's level. So joining us today from UNH should be Raina Ames, who's the chair of theater and dance.
Yes, I'm here.
Joe Anosco, director of education preparation.
Hi, everyone.
And Liz Archeri is the coordinator of accreditation and certification.
Hello, everyone.
And they are here and available if you have any questions regarding their request.
Any questions? Nothing for UNH? Okay. Must be another excellent report.
And Lane, State Board of Education moves to grant approval of a substantive change of two UNH educator preparation programs to offer the bachelor's in addition to the master's level. Theater, MED, MAT, and BA, expiring 5/30/2022. Dance Education, MED, MAT, and BA, expiring 5/30/2022.
Second it, Kate.
Okay,
roll call is Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Phil Nazaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoro?
Yes.
Drew Klein.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Drew, could we take a quick break?
Sure.
Thank you, Helen. Drinking water today. Woo.
Yep, yep. How long?
About five, if that's, does that work?
Sure, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
And this is Liz from UNH. Thanks very much.
Okay, we're just going to stay on the line for anybody who's on the call listening. We're just going to take a five-minute break, so you'll just hear nothing for the next 5 minutes.
go well. The phone keeps hanging up.
That have just arrived to the meeting or on a brief break, we'll be with you shortly.
Hey, Drew, are you there? Drew, are you there?
Hey, you're still on the call, if that's what you're wondering about. You're still on.
Yeah, why did Drew to give me a call? I got a question.
Hey, I'm back.
Hey,
we're back.
Okay.
Is everybody all set? Everybody here?
Yep.
Maybe, Angela, could you do a roll call just to make sure everybody's back?
Sure, happy to. Sally Griffin?
Yes, I'm here.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Phil Nazaro?
I'm here.
Helen Otero?
Present.
Drew Klein?
Present.
All right, thank you.
Okay. So, let me clear out my list here. Charter School reports an update. Jane, are you online?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon, everyone.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Still morning, sorry. Good morning,
Hi, Jane.
Everyone. Hi.
It only feels like afternoon, Jane.
I know.
been a long morning.
Okay, so we're up to A, the Virtual Learning Academy request.
Okay, so the Virtual Learning Academy is requesting an amendment to their charter to increase their grades from their current grades are 4 through 12, and they're requesting an increase to add K through 3. Steve Kosakowski from the CEO of VLAC should be on the call.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you, Jane.
Welcome.
All right, go ahead.
I just like to first of all let you know that yesterday the Virtual Learning Academy Board of Trustees met and unanimously approved a request to change their charter to add grades K through 3. And obviously one of the major reasons for doing this is the belief that there are lots of families and students out there in New Hampshire that are going to have to make some difficult decisions going into the fall. And we really believe that we can help and would like to extend our services to include those families. Just to be clear, we would continue to offer grades K through 3 after the pandemic, but we anticipate that there'll be a significant number of families that may enroll as we go into the fall, and then after a few months return to their schools, which we would certainly support and recommend to them. We would just like to step to the front and be able to help people in New Hampshire. That's really the main reason for doing this. I think there are a lot of additional benefits as we move down the road, because then we will be a complete school system, if you will, grades K through 12 plus adult education. We look forward to making that transition with your approval.
Drew, could I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Steve, I am a big fan of VLAX, and I think you guys have done a wonderful job. Can you tell me what kindergarten online is going to look like?
Yes, at the primary level, obviously we ask the parents to be very much involved. And there are both asynchronous and synchronous components. The curriculum that we're using and that we had already vetted in preparing for grades 4 and 5 is a curriculum from the Florida Virtual School. They've been doing this for a couple of years now and had experience at the elementary level for many years prior to developing the new curriculum. One of the things I like about their curriculum is that it requires kids to do things that are active in addition to some online things. For example, they'll be asked to do a number of activities ranging from very, very basic science experiments to creating dioramas, to creating posters, to creating to using household items to do a variety of activities. So what I like about that is it doesn't cost the family a great deal of money to do that, but it also gets kids active. They're, you know, using these items as manipulatives. And then, of course, either mom or dad are there to help them. Our instructors will be providing instruction, but this is not a case where we ask a student of that age to sit down in front of a computer and just spend hours watching an instructor. They're going to be there to provide individual one-on-one support, as well as be there to do things like have story hour and be talking to a group of kindergartners. I think another advantage of our program is it really allows the parents to structure the day in a way that makes sense for their child. So if, 8 to 9 o'clock is a wonderful time, then they do some work at 8 to 9. And if they need a half hour of play, they can go off and do that. So it's really a program that's designed to allow the parents to have as flexible a schedule as possible.
Are you going to require that there be an adult? I mean, I have this vision of making a volcano and the kindergartner is there doing science experiments. It all sounds, wonderful, but is there going to be a requirement that there be an adult participating?
Yes, there's got to be a parent or guardian who's really bought into, working with a student at home. This is, I heard the discussion earlier about all types of homeschooling, and I think this is another alternative, but it does require a significant investment from the parent to be there. We don't expect the parent to be the teacher, but we do expect them to be supervising. We expect them to, be side by side with children of this age.
Will that be clearly communicated to the adults in the child's life?
Yes. But we have to also understand that we're not going to be supervising that on an ongoing, and by supervising, I mean watching to see what's happening. So we do rely on the parents to make those decisions. The things that, as we think about this program, things that would concern us would be as if we were to get a call from a child care provider saying, I've got 6 kids here. Can I, log all of them into VLAX and do the work? We would ask for individual commitments from parents and guardians.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions? Anne.
Thank you for being here. I certainly appreciate your efforts to support families during this extraordinary time. If we want to get back to normal, I have reservations about a K-3 program being the most appropriate for young children. I'm sympathetic with what Helen was suggesting. Children need socialization with one another. And while today that's very, very difficult, I'm hoping in the future it won't be. And I guess that I can see that you would have certain clientele that your program would be appropriate for, but I just don't personally think it's appropriate for the majority of children in kindergarten through grade.
Yeah, one of the things that we anticipate, I think as I said before, we do anticipate that many of the families who would use us during this time would return to a traditional setting. I think there are a small percentage of parents who would appreciate having curriculum if they're, I shouldn't say that they don't have curriculum, but they would appreciate having access to our services post-pandemic, but maybe not on a full-time basis. Maybe they say, I really feel that I can work with my first grader in mathematics and other areas, but I'd really like some help in teaching reading, and they may reach out to us for that reason. But I would agree that I don't believe this will be a program that would have hundreds and hundreds of students post-pandemic.
I don't want my thoughts to be misconstrued with our homeschool family. I think that they made an enormous effort to integrate their children's education with multiple social activities that fill in that need that young children have. But thank you for that. And again, I'm extraordinarily grateful that you're making your services available to families today at this extraordinary time.
Thank you.
Drew, can I ask one more question?
Helen, and then I think was it Sally, someone else had it.
I'll wait my turn. Go ahead.
And sorry, Ann, I could hardly hear you, but, sir, what's your anticipation for headcount? You know, what is your goal?
I wish I knew. This is just, it's a moving target.
Okay.
We're going to, if approved, we're going to begin hiring experienced K-3 teachers, experienced and certified, and then they'll go through significant training with us to be ready to open in mid to late August. But we really don't know. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the surveys where there can be anywhere from, you know, we've heard anywhere from 8 to 20% of parents are responding that they may not send their students back. Many of those kids, I think, will continue to be served by the local school district with their programs. But I think there will be some schools that perhaps we can help, and maybe there will be other parents who make decisions just to come, a decision to come to us. So what we're going to try to do is have at least you know, 5 to 10 instructors available who could serve, you know, 100 or 200 students. But beyond that, we don't know. And again, we're just trying to, the whole impetus for this was to try to help out.
Steve, this is Frank Edelblue. So Commissioner on the line, if you want, Steve, I can also weigh in a little bit on this if you think it's appropriate.
Yeah, sure.
So part of the genesis of this was a request that I reached out to Steve. We've heard from our superintendents, and particularly some of our superintendents in the rural districts, of some concerns of being able to support all their families, because they may have students who, because of underlying health conditions, either with the student or with a family member, that they're not going to be able to access their education coming back in September and for an unforeseen period of time. And so when I reached out to Steve, it was, would he be able to help us fill this need in the district? There will be districts who have the ability and a capacity to support those students remotely in their district, but there will be other districts that do not have it. And so we're trying to offer to our superintendents an option for all of their families and create a more inclusive educational environment for all New Hampshire families.
Okay. Steve, I noticed down at the bottom of the back of the letter to the commissioner, you've got down here your goal is to make the K-3 full-time. Is that correct?
Yes. When we open, what we anticipate doing is having a full curriculum but not being full-time. And we had planned with grades 4 and 5 to have a full-time program available post-holiday as we go into the new year. And so that's what we were thinking. And two advantages, we're trying to do this on a short timeline, so we want some time to have that in place. But the other thing is, I think there's going to be a great deal of churn. And our experience has been when you go through the transition from one school to another, it takes time. There's an emotional cost. The records moving back and forth can take some time. So I think a secondary advantage is that I believe there'll be lots of families who will come to us for a month or two. And then if the pandemic recedes to some degree and they feel safe, they'll send their kids back. That way they'll still remain a full-time student at the other school and not have to move records back and forth so much. So.
No, I agree with the commissioner. We need some options out there for our students and our parents. Thank you. I'm all set, Drew.
Okay. Helen?
Yeah, Steve, do you feel confident that you'll be able to meet the state standards at kindergarten, at the kindergarten level? I'm also concerned about the other primary grades, but I'd like you to address kindergarten first.
Yes. We would make sure of that before we would open or attempt to open a full-time program. So in going in this fall, we know that the curriculum is aligned to national and state standards. But we, you know, the devil is always in the details, so we want to make sure that we reviewed everything before we establish this as a full-time program.
Okay, and is that true of 1-3 also?
Yes, yes.
So those would be part-time programs? 1-3 also?
No. The entire K-3, again, in the fall would be a full curriculum, but we won't look at opening it as a full-time program until after the holidays and into 2021.
So tell me the difference, just so that I understand it. Could a family enroll come August?
What they would, if they wanted to enroll full-time, what they could do is file a homeschool letter, and then they could access our curriculum to fulfill the needs of their homeschool program. And certainly they could access other options as well. But when August comes, they won't be able to transfer to VLEX as a full-time student.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions or discussion? Motion?
Anne Lane. Pursuant to RSA 194-B:3,10-11, I move that the State Board of Education authorizes Virtual Learning Academy Charter School to amend the charter to add kindergarten through grade 3 K-3 program.
I second it, Kate.
Roll call.
Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Anne Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Phil Nazzaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoreau?
Yes.
Drew Klein?
Abstain.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Okay, next item, NCC renewal.
Hey everyone, this is Jane Waterhouse. I'm going to give you a brief summary of the evaluation and the visitation of the school by the review team. So first of all, I'd like to, several of the administrators, teacher advisors, board members from Making Community Connections, also referred to as MC Squared now, are on the call. So I'd like to introduce John Sobleski, who is the new chief education officer. He's taking over from Kim Carter, who's recently stepped down as the CEO, and she's now a member of the Board of Trustees and the Treasurer. Also on the line is Chris O'Reilly, which is the head of school for the Monadnock campus, Jody Adams, who's the board chairperson, and two teacher advisors, Elizabeth Cardine and Sarah Stout, are on the line.
All right.
The review team really enjoyed the visit, meeting with students and all the stakeholders. The students were very articulate. The staff was very professional, experienced, and fully committed to the mission of the school. Board and administration were very passionate about the program and the educational options that it provides for students. The parents were very grateful that the school met the needs of their children. And the team spent the whole day there. We even witnessed a student defend her
her project for graduation, which was really interesting and very a very professional performance by the students. So the team found that the charter school is making progress towards achieving its mission programmatically, academically, and organizationally. The review team feels that MC Squared has demonstrated that they're meeting or exceeding the achievement of their mission by providing a unique program which ensures that each child ensures each child's success by working with families and communities to support students in their program, which consists of a competency and project-based curriculum, student-designed internships, daily advisories, and the implementation of MC Squared's 17 habits of being and habits of the mind. Through these habits of being and mind, students are able to identify their strengths and weaknesses to overcome any academic challenges resulting in the student's social, emotional, and academic growth and development. And this is a very big component of the school mission. On average, students make no less than 1 year's growth each year in reading, writing, mathematics, science, and social studies. Benchmark achievement and proficiency in competencies increases as students move through the learning phases. Students complete at least two substantive projects each year, participate in one internship in each of the four learning phases, and develop independent or group learning projects. Graduation rates remain low compared to the state and local schools, but showed an increase from 2018 to 2019. Organizationally, MC Squared has developed several organizational goals to build sustainability. For example, increasing stakeholder participation in the site council. The site council is a group that works towards sustainability plans, and it has a large stakeholder group in this council. They develop another goal is to develop a benefits package for their staff and to replace aging technology. Those are just some of the examples. A review of the organizational structure is being undertaken, and plans of action shall be taken to address any areas in need of improvement. We reviewed the board meeting minutes and found they indicated that financial discussions that the school is financially stable, and discussions are held regularly in public session with ongoing updates provided by the Board of Trustees, provided to the Board of Trustees by the administration. Other areas considered in our evaluation were responsible use of public funds, sustainability of the school, progress in promoting student attainment of expected knowledge and skills. And Squared has demonstrated responsible use of public funds. Their fiscal management of the school is sound, allowing it to demonstrate that it manages its use of public funds as agreed with the Department of Education. They have clearly defined internal processes and procedures for the duties and a highly qualified board and staff for oversight. It is clear to all the reviewers that MC Squared has a sustainable model with its committed, experienced, and highly engaged board, a viable financial plan, strong parent and community support, filling an educational void in the community, and a unique, successful approach to learning. MC Squared promotes a culture of high expectations and is committed to the success of each individual student. However, there are a few sustainability concerns that the group interviewed and the reviewers had, which include limited resources, mainly due to insufficient funds from fundraising efforts, the turnover in paraprofessionals, and lower than anticipated enrollment. The interview groups clearly articulated that all the stakeholders feel that a solution to this challenge the sustainability challenges facing the school, which are currently under development by the site committee, can be overcome. M2 has demonstrated adequate progress in promoting student attainment of expected knowledge and skills. The school provides a high-quality, flexible, and multifaceted learning environment for all students. The school complies with state and federal special education laws. MC2 has demonstrated that its programs are indeed achieving their charter's mission and goals in all areas of student personal growth and competency achievement are being met. Other concerns the review team had were from the interviews were that the school needs to develop a more focused and committed data-driven accountability plan to support the school. It needs to improve relationships with ascending school districts in order to better meet the academic needs of students, develop a more robust student recruitment plan or campaign that targets students who would benefit from this type of educational environment, consider revising the orientation process for new students who enter the school at different times during the year in order to minimize disruption to the students that are already working at the school in the program, and improve staff retention by offering a competitive salary and benefit package. We did mention that the school is working on that through the site committee or council. The evaluation team unanimously recommends renewal for making community connections. In this renewal process, MC2 has clearly demonstrated their ability to remain true to their mission and grow their program to deliver a high-quality education for their students. So that's it. Now I open it up to making community connections. I believe they have a statement for you, and then to questions that the board might have.
Hi, this is Kim Carter. I am the founder and was the CEO until June 30th. I'm now on the board and am proud to be a trustee and the treasurer of MC2. I will say, however, I did not know that we are supposed to have a statement for you. So I'm glad that we're here. It's been a very interesting journey. The March 2nd site visit, our world has certainly changed a lot. I'm happy to have John Sabalewski, the new CEO, and I will say he's also the parent of a graduate, MC2 graduate, so he can give you another perspective there. We have Chris O'Reilly, as Jane had said, we have Chris O'Reilly, who is the school leader for the Monadnock campus, Jody Adams, our board chair, and we have a couple other people, but I don't believe they're on as speaking guests. So we're happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions?
Yep, Drew, it's Kate.
Hey, Kate, go ahead.
And it might be for the commissioner, I'm not sure. I noticed in their board of trustees that they only have 6, and it should be 7. Back in 2000, I got the minutes from the 2004 meeting, that it says here, the Board of Trustees, that follows the guidelines set forth in the charter school application that was submitted to the Department of Education. So it might have been on that back then in 2004, and it says 7 voting members, 2 parents are required, 2 professional educators, direct service providers, and 3 community members. So I saw 6. I don't know if that makes a difference or not. This guideline here, I don't know if it's still in effect. I didn't think it changed. This is something we may want to think about it. And I think it's on page, I didn't see 7, so, and I was reading all about their background.
sorry, what document are you referring to?
When North Country Charter School was one of the first that opened up and probably had one of the first applications, and on that application from the DOE, it said that you had to have come up with a board of trustees, 7 voting members, and it broke it down. I don't know, and I haven't had time to go find the application. I think I've got it, but it's somewhere. And I'm not sure of the RSA, and I haven't been at home, so I don't have the book. So that's where I am with that. I was just wondering, why has it changed or anything? Maybe Frank knows or Drew? I didn't think it did.
I can try looking up the RSA, and I'm sorry if I'm speaking out of turn, but our bylaws and our charter state in accordance with RSA 194B, Section 5, that will be governed by a board of 5 to 12 member board.
Okay. I just wondering if it changed. And it doesn't break down the voting members or the quantity? I'd have to look it up. I'm not near anything. It says 2 parents are required, 2 professional educators or direct service providers, and 3 community members. Did they change that, Commissioner?
Hi, this is Nate. I have my book open. I'm trying to take a look at it right now.
So if I can jump in, this is Nate.
Whoops. Go ahead. I'll mute it. Hold on.
Sorry. I've been raising my hand. I'm just not sure if it's popping up for anyone. So that, it sounds like that might have been something that was an internal process maybe years ago within the department itself. As far as I know, that particular makeup for a board does not exist either within the administrative rules or within the RSA itself.
Okay. I wondered that. It looks like it was on the application. I know, 2004 to 2020, I know things have changed, and maybe they changed their application between now and then.
Right, and I think that was probably, it might have been an internal decision, it might have been something that, had been a discussion and was placed on an application, but there's no statutory background to that.
Okay, that's what I wondered. Thanks, Nate.
Sure.
Any other questions?
No, but I thought the report was great. I'd love the breakdown of the finances, the 5-year goals. I like the breakdown of the fundraisers. It was a very good report. Thank you.
Kate, I was going through the financial section thinking of you the entire time, and I thought, you're going to love this.
Me too. On time.
First thing, Drew,
can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for the report. It was a delight and made me smile. And Jane, thank you for your representation to us today. It was very helpful. I'm wondering if, and I know you weren't prepared to have any sort of a statement, if you would be able to at all address the recommendations that the team provided, such as the use of data. Do you have any response to what the school is going to do?
Oh, yes, I'm happy to talk about that. All of their recommendations were completely in line with items that we've been working on and are committed to. The board's Academic Excellence Committee is looking at metrics that measure the things that we say in our charter that we value. Some board members will remember that I was there not too long ago, although it does seem like a whole other universe. I think it was in February to request an amendment to our charter, and that was specifically for our first goal, so that we have benchmarks around the percentage of competencies that are being completed as students move through their journey to graduation. So we're looking at a number of different metrics and data points, and we're in the process of finalizing transition to a student information system that has a lot more capability and capacity for giving us ongoing reports and data. and that we can integrate with our learning management system. So the data piece is top of our list, both on the board and with the school administration. I'd say that enrollment is top of the list for our site council, the Monadnock Site Council, and our new CEO, John Sabalewski. So one or more of them may want to speak to that. I think fundraising has actually been a relative strength for the Monadnock School, but it's there's always a need for more. So if you have the fundraising report, you can see they've raised over $100,000 in their first 5 years at that campus. So they've been strong about that, and they continue to grow goodwill and build, regular fundraisers that have become part of the fabric of the community. And one of those in particular, if you're ever looking for a good comedy night out, is Let It Slide, which happens twice a year. And they get local people of significance, I will say, to come do improv. And one of the last winners was the president of Keene State College. That was kind of fun. So fundraising is another significant piece that they are paying attention to. I will say I think they've made tremendous progress in terms of retention of staff. Chris, the school leader, may want to speak to that, but at this point, everybody is returning from this past year, and they've built a really strong team. So I think that that's a really positive development. We also have some changes in administration in local school districts that we think will build some increasing relationships, strengthen relationships, and hope to look at the ways we can improve those relationships with sending school districts. The orientation process was something that was already in the process of being updated and revised, and Sarah Stout, one of the advisor teachers who's on the call, or at least listening to the call, has been very instrumental in developing that process. I'm trying to see if I've missed anything here. John or Chris, do you want to add anything around the recommendations and the goals and how what your plans are for that? I feel like a lot of them are well in progress. I'll add one more piece. I think Elizabeth Cardine, who's also on the call, has done an exceptional job of outreach to build relationships both with the local Chamber of Commerce and other organizations such as the Hannah Grimes Incubator Center and some other great partnerships in the area. So
okay, any other thoughts or questions?
Yeah, Jane?
Okay.
Is Jane there? Or maybe somebody from there can answer me.
Yes, I'm here. Hello. Hi, yeah. Kate.
On the concerns or do you have any, due dates when they're going to be completed? I'm not sure if I worded that right.
You mean If I've developed like a action plan for them to complete,
yeah, but you had some concerns, and it sounds like they're already working on them. I didn't know if they were going to put after you do these reviews, do you do a follow up date, a deadline date for them to have it complete?
At this time, I do not, but it's a really good recommendation, and it's something that I will follow up with Nate to develop.
Might want to, yeah, something, you know, we keep track of it so we don't have anything fall back. But
right,
otherwise,
great idea.
I thought, what's that, Jane?
It's a great idea, Kate. Thank you.
And just to the school, I enjoyed reading your report. I tell you, I was excited. but I really enjoyed all the information. The way it was set up was excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to give a shout out to Chris O'Reilly, the school leader. He worked incredibly diligently on pulling together data and having it make sense and be accessible, and just a tremendous job putting together the application.
Yeah, in your relationship with your chamber and with your superintendents, are very, very important for the success of a charter school. Very important.
We do look to North Country as a model for how to do this work. So, thank you.
Who doesn't?
Okay, how about a motion?
Ann Lane, pursuant to ED318.12 and ED318.13, I move that the State Board of Education authorize the charter renewal for Making Community Connections Charter Public School in Monadnock.
I'll second it.
All right, roll call. Sally Griffin?
Yes.
Ann Lane?
Yes.
Kate Cassidy?
Yes.
Del Nazaro?
Yes.
Helen Honoro?
Yes.
Drew Klein.
Sustained.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jane, and thank you, everybody, from Lindsay Squared.
Thank you so much.
Great You're report. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. We're winding down. Commissioner's update.
Great, and thank you for having me. Let me join you today. Lots going on, actually. I will give you some high-level things, and then there may be some areas that you all want to lean in on. The place that I will start is with the School Transition Reopening and Redesign Task Force, the START Task Force. They wrapped up their work last Monday and passed off to the department at that point, high-level recommendations, kind of a framework, and then sub-recommendations underneath that. The department then spent the next few days taking a vast amount of content that we had received through the work groups and through the community or the surveys that we did out in the field. Over 56,000 surveys were ultimately received. So we took all of that information and we fleshed out with a great deal of detail the recommendations, those high-level recommendations that START handed off to us. And I just want to pause for a moment here. So AIR from the Comprehensive Center for Region 1 has been our facilitation partner throughout this work, and they have been incredibly helpful and flexible and a great partner in terms of, you know, managing vast amounts of information and getting through there. So the department fleshed out some detailed reopen guidance. We handed that off to the governor's office and Health and Human Services. Health and Human Services has that guidance now and is working through that to make sure that the guidance that START came up with and that really the department kind of fleshed out based on the content that we had fits within the framework that both the governor and Health and Human Services have with respect to the health and safety of our students and our staff coming back into school to START in September. I can tell you that if there's anyone, any of the board members who are interested, the START work is all transparently documented on the department's website. There is a START page. All of the, communications and content and everything else are out there. In addition to, there's another piece of information that's out there. We have not yet publicized this out there because we're still working on some of the compliance things associated with it. But we have published all of the survey results out on the web page right now. They are in an Excel format. And so one of the requirements for the state we have is to make sure that all of the stuff that we put on the web is fully accessible to anybody who needs to get it. And by that, they are really looking at does it use open source applications? Obviously, Excel is not an open source application, so we are working on trying to compile that information into a PDF so that anybody would, without having to buy Excel, would be able to get at those results. But they are out on the START webpage right now and available for folks who want to START spending some time with those survey results because there's a lot of them out there. The work that will continue with respect to reopening. is that this START work will come out. HHS will provide their guidance. We will publish a guidance document. We are working closely with districts who are also working locally on what their reopening plans will look like in their communities. And so all of this will kind of merge, and we'll have good, strong back-to-school in September plans for our various districts. Just reflecting a little bit on the work of START that I think is important is the importance for districts to be able to respond to their communities in two important ways. One is, from coming out of the survey results in particular, and I think Steve Kozakowski referenced this a little bit earlier, there are not an insignificant number of families who may, because of underlying health risks, find themselves in, and it could be families, it could be educators as well, needing to remain in some type of a remote model. And so we're working with the schools to make sure that we're able to accommodate those families. And in particular, the work that you just did by opening up the K-3 for VLACs is going to help districts support the needs of those families that are coming back. But then the other thing that we are encouraging districts to spend some time with is how to respond to either an actual or a suspected case of COVID in their communities. To make sure that that strong communication plans are in place, that strong response plans are in place, so that we can both handle the exigent circumstances that we may find ourselves in, but it doesn't become too disruptive to the work that we're doing. If, for example, a particular school has a incident in their school, working with Health and Human Services, does that mean that we're going to be having to move out of the building for maybe 3 days while we do some deep cleaning? Are we going to just have certain classrooms that we're working with? Or are we going to have to find ourselves in a quarantine situation for 14 days? What we don't want is that those types of events to be disruptive to the students' learning. We want to be as seamless as we can to be able to have continuity in the learning in person and remote where that's required. So that work continues on. Part of supporting that flexible and nimble environment is a part of the CARES Act investment that the state is making around a statewide learning management system implementation. So we are working in partnership with the University System of New Hampshire, and in particular UNH, to be able to offer to all of our districts a statewide license to Canvas. And so this would really create a statewide learning management system for K through 20. The university system was also already using Canvas. The community college system was already using Canvas. Some of our districts were, but now we're going to make that available to all of our districts to have a learning management system. And I don't know if any of the board members are familiar with Canvas, but it is a system, again, that's used extensively in the higher education environment. But it is a system that's very effective when you're doing in-person instruction. But if you're doing in-person instruction and you find that you have to pivot to a remote instruction model, it transitions very well that way also. So that this type of technology investment will really allow our schools to have a certain amount of nimbleness to be able to respond to whatever circumstances we find ourselves in as we enter into the fall learning. And that's moving forward. That Canvas implementation will come with some add-ons, including a program called Cultura, which allows districts to do a better job and more easily manage video content. Again, a tool already used by the university system, as well as statewide Zoom licenses. By buying statewide Zoom licenses, we just can get a much better and more affordable deal for all of the different school systems that are having to invest in that. The approach in terms of a statewide learning management system are not unique in our movement there. States like Utah, Wyoming, Indiana to a great extent, and North Carolina are also states that have these implementations available to your school systems with a great deal of success. The next thing that I just wanted to bring up is relative to the ESSER grants. As many of you know, we have made available to the districts the $33 million of CARES Act funds that we received from the U.S. Department of Education through the CARES Act. Those are out there, and schools have are in the process of filing their applications. So far, 35 applications have been approved. Eight of them yesterday, anyways, eight of them were in review, and four had been submitted and had not yet been picked up for review. They might have gotten picked up yesterday. We still have 132 districts that have not submitted their applications to access their CARES funds. So we're hoping that, and we were on a call yesterday with school leaders and encouraging them to kind of move forward with that. Another couple of things that I just wanted to, these are more just newsy kinds of things as opposed to specific policy, but earlier this week, working in conjunction with Health and Human Services and the New Hampshire National Guard, we packaged up 25,000 wellness kits for students in New Hampshire. This was a program that we had, Health and Human Services had reached out to us and said that they had a whole bunch of these dental kits available to students. And they were wondering if we had the capacity to try and get them out to the students. Knowing that we're delivering hundreds of thousands of meals to kids on a regular basis, we felt that we could get those out in a good way. We asked districts, you know, who was interested, and we were very quickly oversubscribed. We only had 25,000 wellness kits. We had requests for well more than that before we cut off the requests. But those are going out, and I say to folks, it's going to be like Christmas in July when these kids get these little packets. It's going to be fun. The other project that continues to move forward is the broadband expansion that is being run through the Office of Strategic Initiative. That RFP was out there. The RFP closed, and I know that there were a number of proposals that were submitted that are going to be going through a review process. We're excited about that because it affords the opportunity for more of our families, and in particular our students and our educators who are working or may find themselves having to work in a distance environment to be better supported. So continuing to work to try and close the digital divide. So lots of activities happening at the department. And so those are some of the things that are happening, but I'm happy to take any questions if folks are curious about other things that are happening at the department.
Questions? All right, good report. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, anything for open board discussion before we get to the end of the agenda? We've got consent agenda and non-public coming up.
Drew, were we going to talk about the fiscal impact statement at all? Wasn't on the agenda. We were provided it because I think you asked that we be provided with it.
Yeah, I didn't have it on the agenda because we didn't get it until pretty late. But
yeah.
If you want to discuss it now, that's totally fine.
Okay. I just wondered how the conclusion was reached that it wouldn't cost anyone anything. I mean, I certainly think that school districts will have a cost to implement a remote program of the same rigor, intensity, you know, I don't have the proposed rules in front of me, but you know what I'm referring to. How can that be of no cost?
I don't know the methodology that went into that.
Who would?
Anybody else? I'm not sure. I'm trying to, I need to read over this and refresh my memory on it, but Commissioner, do you know the process for making that fiscal impact statement that we got?
I don't, and so I can tell you I actually haven't seen it yet, so I'm not sure.
Okay, here's what it says, zero. I mean, it just says that there's no cost. At least that's the way I read it. And so I'm wondering who crafted that and how they decided that. I guess it wasn't you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. Just how can we find the answer to that? And because I'd like an answer to that.
I can chase that down.
Is Amanda still on the line? I don't know. She might be on.
Yeah, I'm sure she's with us.
Yeah.
And I would have asked when she was on, but it wasn't on the legislative update, so I didn't ask it then.
I think that's a good question, and I'm happy to track that down. I don't know in this particular instance, but I do know when these things are generally the fiscal impact statements are made. And I'm just speaking generally here. I don't know that this was the case for this one, but often there's a limit to what information can be gathered to make a determination on what the impact would be. And if they can't determine definitively there would be an impact, I think sometimes there's an assumption that it's not significant enough to say that it's going to be a significant impact, because it may be a small cost that can be adjusted within a budget and so forth. That's just a general statement. I don't really know specifically what the process was for this, but we can find out.
Okay. And, I'm thinking about an article that was in the Nashua Telegraph this week that said, just by way of example, Superintendent Mosley saying that it would cost $800,000 to get Chromebooks for students who require them. So, that's one piece in one district. I have nothing other than I read it in the Telegraph. So, trying to understand how it could say there won't be any costs was surprising to me. So how can we get information on that?
I'll ask Amanda and see if we can track down the process there.
And I can track it down as well.
Okay, and could we get some information about it? Because we have like hearing next week. I assume that'll be sent. Does that get sent before we have our public hearing? Or I know that's why we couldn't have our public hearing this month, because the fiscal impact statement hadn't been done. So I'm just wondering who that got sent to and.
Yeah, we can talk
about Helen, this is Angela. Yes. I think Amanda's on the line. I think Amanda's as a speaker right now. Amanda, are you there?
I am here, actually in the Burger King line getting lunch for my son.
Okay.
Sorry. So we might get interrupted.
Well, that's okay. I don't know if you caught any of that, but Helen's question was, what was the methodology behind the fiscal impact statement? Was there, what was the process and who made that determination that there would be no cost?
There are very specific questions that you have to answer in a request for a fiscal impact statement. And the questions are how the new rule relates to the old rule, and if there's a cost increase between the proposed rule and the old rule. I don't have my notes in front of me for what we actually wrote in the answers. I just have the fiscal impact statement. I don't have the request, but I can forward our request to the board so you could see what our answers were. And then from our answers, the legislative budget assistant makes a determination of the fiscal impact.
Thank you, Amanda. That's helpful, and I think that would be helpful to see. So numbered paragraph 3 says costs and benefits of the proposed rule, there may be nothing to the state, to state citizens and political subdivisions. It would seem to me that the requirement there be remote learning program of the same rigor available to everyone with no limitations on that would certainly have an impact that's different than the old rule, because that wasn't a requirement. I had
right.
before
and
you
I
got on
that.
Is that, just by way of example, I'm sure there are many, many other districts that have costs. There was an article in our local newspaper that said, just for Chromebooks, it would be an $800,000 cost to be able to give Chromebooks to students, which related to remote learning. So that's what made me, and then when we got this, I just wondered how that could be if, to say, the state citizens and political division cost.
So I don't. We can dig into that, Helen, to figure it out. I guess the one thing that I want to encourage the board to address. So first of all, like, you know, Chromebooks are something that you use for in-person instruction and not in-person. So I'm not sure the context of the quote from the newspaper article. But I think one of the things that this board should consider is that the emergency rule will expire. And so superintendents are trying to make plans to be able to support their school communities this fall. They need some type of a remote learning capability so that they can, you know, effectively do that. And as an example, I know, like, in one conversation I had with a particular district, you know, not knowing what the fall will look like and how nimble they'll have to be, one particular district I know was looking at doing what they're calling a 4-1. So they're going to have in-person instruction 4 days, and then they're going to run remote instruction every 1 day every week because they don't want to lose the learning that they got through this last pandemic education process, and they want to be able to be nimble, to be able to respond. So they're finding ways to integrate this into their instructional models that will both give them, you know, the nimbleness and the flexibility that they're going to need to be able to respond to circumstances on the ground, as well as in the conversations with that superintendent around that type particular model, he feels like that there's going to be some ways for them to provide additional supports for students who ordinarily might be struggling. And so, again, I just encourage the board to remember that districts are trying to develop these plans, and we need to have the ability to do that. Otherwise, we potentially find ourselves in circumstances of not being able to be nimble, not being able to be responsive. I just want to make sure that we're aware of that.
I'm not commenting on whether that provision should be in the rules which we're having a public hearing on. My question really is, how did we get here to that there won't be any cost? I think the context in which I mentioned that particular article, I think, was about remote instruction, but I would certainly go back and read it. And I'm not suggesting, as I sit here right now, that the rule should be taken out. What I'm saying is that I didn't understand how we could say there would be no fiscal impact. So
Amanda's responded to the process, and we'll chase that down for you. But I just want to make sure that as a board, we don't lose sight of the big picture of supporting the schools in educating the kids.
I don't see those as connected in any way, but I certainly agree with you.
Okay. Any other discussion? Anybody else have general topics they wanted to talk about? Okay, so I want to move on to, we're going to skip the tabled item and go to the consent agenda. Any issues, corrections with the meeting minutes?
Drew, I had one.
Okay.
Page 4948, in the second to the last sentence, I think the word should be retraction versus redaction.
Thanks, Helen. I'll make that change.
Okay.
Anybody else have anything? I have on Angela on page 4974. It's a very minor thing, but it annoyed me. In the last paragraph, the first sentence, through the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security CARES Act, New Hampshire received $37 million worth. When you have a dollar sign, you don't need the word dollars.
I got it. I'll make that update, too.
Okay. All right, motion to accept the minutes.
So moved.
Okay, that was Ann Lane motioning, moving to accept the minutes. Do we have a second?
Second, Kate.
I'll second it.
Oh, Kate got it.
All right.
Roll call.
Sally Griffin.
Yes.
Ann Lane.
Yes.
Kate Cassidy.
Yes.
Bill Nazaro.
Yes.
Helen Honoro.
Yes.
Drew Klein.
Abstain. So now we have, I need to go into non-public session under RSA 91A 3:2C, or 3:2C, matters which, if discussed in public, would likely affect adversely the reputation of any person other than a member of this board, unless such person requests an open meeting. We will need a motion to go into non-public and a roll call vote.
Notion to go into public non-public session.
Who is that?
Kate.
Kate, do we have a second?
I'll second it, Sally Griffin.
Yeah, Sally with a second. So roll call.
Sally Griffin.
Yes.
Ann Lane.
Yes.
Kate Cassidy.
Yes.
Bill Nazaro.
Yes.
Helen Honoro.
Yes.
Drew Klein.
Mistake.
I think Jennifer has an update on how to proceed with this. I don't think we have to hang up. Jennifer, are you still on the line? And can you provide us with an update on how to go into non-public?
Sure. I'm going to go ahead and remove all of the individuals who are not listed as part of the board at this time. So if there are currently any individuals on the line who are not part of the board, you can disconnect your call. Your call will be disconnected for you. Once I have confirmed that only the remaining board members are going to be a part of this, then I will stop the recording and I will start the recording for the non-public. So I will give you guys the cue when it's time to go.
Before you do that,
quick question. I believe there's department staff that you may want on the call.
Yeah,
as well.
we need
Is that the Department of Education staff list?